I'm going to ask a question off the record. What about Mr. McKenna's papers?
They're in the collection at Liberty. What's his name? Walter Young has what he calls the Angus McKenna's collection, and it's been widened out to include most labor and socialist. There was a young fellow here by the name of Stuart who was working on this, and then he sent to Africa to do some CISO work or something, and then something else opened up. He worked on it for quite a while. I had a rough... I hope somebody will write Angus Wright, because he was a key figure. He's a key figure in both the labor, the union, and the political. Mm-hmm. He's a side both. Mm-hmm. And that was a rather unusual combination.
Very much so,
this is interesting. He defended the city on the Oriental question, yes. Because it was a great deal of support among the union people for exclusion of Oriental.
Absolutely, yes. And then, too, another thing, you see, he refused. I mean, one of the very few people in our own party who refused to have any affiliation or recognition within our party of the Communist Party. Now, there was one stage at which practically all the leadership of our party was in favor of some kind of United Front or liaison or something. And yet he didn't turn himself into a rabid communist hunter at all. And when the federal government was, trying to drive them underground, he stood up for their right to be a legal party,
One thing I was going to ask you about, too, if you can tell us anything about this, we've noticed that in looking, trying to find material on the Depression period, we can find a great deal about single and exploited men, we can find out about people on relief, but it's very difficult to find out what happened to single women during the Depression.
I don't think they existed in anybody's mind.
There was agitation.
One very interesting thing was during the war, about 1943, I was on a subcommittee at the federal government's Rehabilitation Committee. I was a committee to report on the post-war problems of women. And there were 10 women across Canada on it. And one of the things that we agitated and fussed a good deal about was standards for people in domestic service, women in domestic service. Well,
this was 1933.
It wasn't many years after that that we realized that the women in domestic service had disappeared into the war plan. And they never came out as far as domestic service was concerned.
Yeah.
That's right.
And they still are out.
Yes.
But there was no concern about them during the Depression period?
Women, if they'll take a mean enough job, I think women can get jobs easier than men at any time, if they'll take a mean enough job.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that any woman is forced into prostitution? It's difficult.
I don't know. Some would say they have been, of course.
When they might have done it by choice. Well, I think it's something that they're going to do more research on. You were talking about the formation of the CCF earlier, and you noted the contact that your father had with so many groups. He also worked with farm laborers living in Dallas Ferry, didn't he?
Yes, although that came, I think, really later. I think the genesis of the thing, it began in mind you, he long before he went near politics, when he was still in the... He covered Western Canada, and not only Western Canada, but all over, really, in several capacities. He was connected. He was one of those that helped to form the first community chest, whatever it was called, way back. He helped to form that way back. His idea then was organized charity. He had no use for the Christmas hamper, Lady Bountiful approach at all. You can find that in his early writing. And he wanted organized charity. If we did it in an organized way, we could look after people. And I have seen, I remember very definitely when people would come to the door when I was a child. Instead of sort of giving them a hand and sending them away, he would not rest. He would take them or see that they were got directions to the nearest mission or so on, or wherever it was that they could get a meal and some place to go, you see. He never was content with this individual handout there. So it began. And then he traveled all over. In that, when he was still at that sort of stage. And then again, when he started doing the prairie surveys of these different immigrant groups, he got to know them. And then I guess he branched out and got to know farm groups and labor groups in a way, although not in a purposeful way at that time, I think, but the groundwork was there.
Yeah.
And then when he was elected to Parliament, you see, Bill Irwin was a labor member from Calgary, elected at that time, and then... When just gradually, see, they had to find their feet and everything. Every modern thing they wanted to do, I remember father's first speech was on unemployment. And it was just like if somebody had brought a dog into the Holy of Holies in the church or something. It was just not out of place. They were there to discuss, it was a gentleman's club, to discuss delicate little tariffs and railways and that kind of thing, national defense, and nothing more modern much than that. And so that they were finding their way. And then also, the contacts were widening with the farm people. But there was always this thing, up all the way through the 30s, when the farm people and the labor people, which were only two or three, Irvin and Heaps and my father, whenever they would get together, the farm people were interested in talking monetary reform. And I know my father hadn't very much use for this as being too fundamental, but he would be patient. But Irvin got very impatient, and I remember, I think I mentioned this in my book, at one stage, when they'd gone again and again and again over some matter, they always insisted on bringing this into every resolution or every motion before Parliament. Irvin jumped up, and he said, "What's the use of churning rotten buttermilk?" And my father said, "If language of that kind is going to be used, I'm going to go." And he starts to leave. Irvin says, "Go, go." My father firmly sat down. He realized that, you see. Yeah. So then it was gradually held together. Well, then you see there's the secret, the Depression was what was the catalyst. Mm-hmm. When the Depression came, the United Farmers of Alberta had met in convention earlier that year. Mm-hmm. And not earlier that year. The first people to meet, I think, were the Western Labor Conference. Mm-hmm. He had been meeting for each year for quite a while, and they had met in And then, the United Farmers of Alberta met. I'm not sure when they got out that manifesto. It must have been before they met. Yes, it was before they met, I guess. Where they issued an invitation to all groups that were interested in forming a cooperative commonwealth to get together with them. So then the labor people came over to the farm conference. And that was the beginning of the really organized driving in on the thing. Yeah. And then, of course, at Regina, the following year was the first convention. Now, there weren't too many organized. There were organized labor groups there. But at that time, these labor parties were organized like little bits in the city. So there was no collusion or no cooperation among them. Vancouver had the Socialist Party of Canada. Calgary had the Dominion Labor Party and the Canadian Labor Party. Regina had the Independent Labor Party. Winnipeg had the Independent Labor Party. Ontario had four labor parties, each one of which wanted to swallow the others whole. And that was it. And they all somehow got together. And the farmers were there. Agnes MacPhail was just on pins every time she... she was trying to get the farmers kept in there and trying to hide from them the nasty kind of thinking of the BC socialists. And, of course, when Angus discovered that she was shy about this language, he went and did what he hardly ever did do, out of plain mischief. He kept addressing her as Comrade MacPhail. And this made her just infuriated because it meant that she couldn't hold the farmers, you see. They were so then she said that she was going to leave this convention. If this sort of thing went on, she was going to leave this convention, and she was going to take the farmers of Ontario with her. And then Angus said what made her so infuriated that he had an idea that he really didn't feel this way at all himself, because he felt very definitely that the convention could get on without him, and he had a suspicion that maybe he could get along without the member for East Grey or whatever she was. And this made her so angry that for quite a long time she wouldn't speak to him at all. And then what happened was, she's very fond of Bob Gardner. As a matter of fact, Bob left her the little fortune he had. He would have liked to marry her, but she had vowed that she'd never get married. And he was in very poor health. And Angus had been studying, making studies of health and health foods and health routines for quite a few years. And so he took to conciliating Agnes by giving her little helpful hints for Bob, you see. And oh, then she warmed right up and it was all right again.
So there were contacts with farmers, with Prairies, BC, Ontario. Was there any attempt to make contact with Quebec? It seems to me that the only place your father didn't have a link was the French-Canadian part of Quebec.
No, there was nothing French-Canadian in there, except, I guess it wouldn't be French-Canadian. There was Reconstruction. Now, there were professors there. Indirect links, you see, there would be Frank Scott and there was Gordon.
Yeah, they were the guilty.
Oh, Gordon wasn't there. Yes, Gordon. You know who I mean. Now, wait a minute. From Winnipeg. What's that name? His father was Ralph Connor.
Oh, I see.
King Gordon. I think he was attached.
But these are all...
Is he guilty?
I think so, yeah. Later on. And what's his name? Forsey was there. There was this link, but I don't think there were French Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
And as to unions as such, there was only one. CBFRE, Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Employees, was Mosher. It was really Mosher.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, it was 37 before we got the first official affiliation of a union, or 37, 38, with the United Mine Workers in Nova Scotia. And they've been loyal all over the years.
Was your father ever concerned about this fact that it had been impossible for the group to make contact in Quebec?
Oh, yes. He used to go down to Quebec quite regularly in the 30s, and I would go with him because I could... he used to have me translating little pieces of what he would say, and... it was a terrible ordeal for me. You see, I'd had a year in France, but that wasn't very much, and I was very shrinking, and I'd come back and my neck would be just so stiff and sore for about a week after the ordeal of doing it. But mind you, it was an ordeal to go to those meetings, because in Quebec, in the, see, this was, this lasted into the 40s, but even in the 30s, there was this growing ARCOM movement, the fascist movement, and there were very strong currents there. And by the time you got a meeting called with Jewish people and French Canadians and English and then the fascist persuasions and some other communist persuasions, you really had a feeling that you were sitting on top of Vesuvius, who had a mind to just get active on the thing. Mm-hmm. I remember at one time Dan Lewis presiding at a meeting where he couldn't get order at all and seizing the water jug and bashing it down and it smashed. But I think he got order. It was a very difficult thing. And Father used to make these forays quite regularly. The meetings were in the big marshes, Atwater and Saint-Jacques.
Oh, yeah. And he would be speaking in English?
Oh, yeah, he didn't know any French at all.
He spoke in English, and you translated.
Well, just little bits. It was just pure gesture. But
did you speak to me, or just write it down?
No, I spoke. Oh, I had to. I wasn't in French writing down. But he always... Father was very, very sympathetic to any of his children who wanted to learn French.
Mm-hmm.
He let the boys know that if any time they wanted to go and live in a French-speaking family, that he'd be very happy to try and find one. And one of my brothers did go for a while to
live in Quebec.
Yes, for a summer, I think, or mm-hmm. part of a summer. And he was very sympathetic to... he regretted very much that he didn't have the language himself.
Mm-hmm.
Bourassa was one of his friends...
The old Henry, eh?
Yes. Mind you, their views were, they were only in agreement on one thing, and that was the badness of Britain. And I remember, but they were both very sincere people, and I remember Bourassa saying to Father at one time, he said, Mr. Wordsworth, I wish you were a Catholic, because if you were a Catholic, you would be such a good Catholic.
Isn't that lovely?
Yes.
Very interesting.
I was just going to ask you, and this is changing the subject, what your perception of why Saskatchewan tended to go toward more toward a radical left party and Alberta toward a radical right party.
I think that probably two things have been outstanding about Alberta. One is that it's had the resources. It's been pretty wealthy, not just a one-crop province like Saskatchewan was all over here. And the other thing, I think Alberta has had very heavy infusions from south of the line.
Mm-hmm.
It's had organizational infusions from the farm people. It's had ethnic infusions. It's had that Mormon infusion. And it's had now one of the most nefarious things. Well, it had all the monetary business. But it also has all these hot gospelers in great profusion. And this has, all of this has conspired to make Alberta very much more conservative than either of the other two provinces, I think. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but these are the factors that seem to me relevant.
There are others who would feel this way.
Why were they so hot on monetary reform so early from Alberta?
I don't really know. There must have been some early leader. How did Henry Wisewood stand on that? Do any of you know?
He was the one that introduced it.
Was he?
Yeah.
Because he had a great influence. And you see, Bill Irvin, in spite of all his good qualities, he's one thing I remember about him was he was responsible for bringing over Major Douglas to the Banking and Commerce Committee.
Oh, and they came to the
and that was another shot in the arm for this thing, you see. It was a very... they believed if you had the monetary system... and yet they didn't want... I don't think they wanted all the private banks taken over.
No.
I don't think they did.
I think they wanted money...
Yes.
Reform within the federal system.
Exactly. I don't think they thought it through ever. All they had thought through to the last tedious detail was the A plus B theorem,
which, thank God, nobody could ever understand.
But that's what they remarked, really. That, yeah. That sort of perverted that idea.
Well, I remember on one occasion, right after we were at Regina, we had a little research bulletin at the time, and the early CCF research bulletin, and they ran little articles about this and that. Mm-hmm. And the monetary reformers wanted to put an article in, of course, about monetary reform. So somebody had the right, there was a lot of good, clever thinking had to go on in those days. Somebody had a bright idea. Well, if it was to be about social credit, better get a social creditor to do it, because after all, that was the fountain of wisdom. So the second piece of wise thinking was that if such an article were written by any given person, it must be authorized by the social credit league or whatever it was before we put it in our magazine as being the gospel truth. Well, that's as far as it got, because there was no way in which social credit would ever find an article that was perfect enough to go into the small compass of our thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that they fell among themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Throughout the Depression, you campaigned in quite a number of provinces. Did you notice anything very distinctive about the reaction to British Columbia,
the British Columbia has always had, it's been more militant than other provinces, probably in every way, and certainly in socialist thinking, we've got a mixture here in British Columbia of two strains. There was a strain of people that came in from Britain who were, some people wouldn't say they were militant at all, but they were British labor leaders with the training of labor people, and they may not have been militant, but they believed in getting things done. I mean, the gradualism, step by step, and they didn't believe in theorizing and doing nothing about it, but they believed in doing things, a sewer and water kind of thing. They were deadly persistent and very steady at it. That was one strain. The Marxian socialists always referred to them very scornfully as utopians. The other strain was the people that came from Europe, and also the people, I guess, from north of the Clyde, and some very, very militant types from Britain, the Marxian kind, that prided themselves on being atheists and that believed that we had to have violence. Nearly all of them believed that. Certainly, they believed that things had to get a lot worse before they could get better. And they were the ones that, if you talked about improving anything, oh, why patch up the rotten old sinking ship of capitalism, let her go down, without any raft in sight, of course. And so we have the two strains out here. And for a long time, we had strains in the beginning CCF, because there was the old Socialist Party. At first had no use at all for the CCF, and then when it realized it was going ahead, it wanted to have a monopoly of organization. But in the meantime, pressure had forced the formation of CCF clubs, because these people wouldn't be caught dead, professional people and so on, wouldn't be caught dead as members of the Socialist Party. They had no use for the Socialist Party. So that the two things grew up, and if we had allowed the two things to continue and fight indefinitely, I don't suppose we would be have a party here. But there again, Angus was crucial, because Angus, he had come to terms with both those strains and had a foot in probably both camps. And I remember at one of such meetings, we invited the leaders of both groups within the party to our little apartment in Vancouver, and there was an evening to place, a confrontation, and I thought we would be put out that night. But it was a good, hard, stiff fight in which a lot of plain talk went on, pointing out exactly what would happen if they couldn't get together and didn't. So the upshot was that in 35, there was the convention was held at which amalgamation took place. Well, it wasn't easy for a long time, and everybody accused everybody else of not being real socialist or else of being communist or this or that. But finally, you see, the lines of demarcation wore out. Manitoba had a tougher time, because the ILP people were very, very intransigent. Mm-hmm. They didn't want any clubs.
Mm-hmm.
diluting their pure drink. And it took a long time there to get rid of it. As a matter of fact, my father was on the point of resigning, was going to resign from the party, because he was ILP. Mm-hmm. And if the ILP, who did he represent, you see? Mm-hmm. But the party wouldn't hear of it. They indicated that that little Manitoba, several little Manitoba's difficulties mm-hmm. saw fit. But
do you think this is one of the explanations for the CPF not making greater headway in, say, the 33 election?
Oh, I think over the years, and I've said this many times, I think that one of the greatest difficulties in our coming to power was ourselves. Because, you see, we were trying to put in all the, we included all the kinds of elements.
Mm-hmm.
And we were subject to all the diseases that a growing movement, like a growing child, is subjected to. We went through the fight first ideologically between the those two wings that I pointed out, and some people that didn't belong to any wings at all. We had to strain out quite a few nuts that left of their own accord after they realized that nobody was interested in them, in their ideas. And then there was the communist movement kept us in a ferment for many years. As I say, we upheld the right of the Communist Party to exist legally, but we didn't want them existing inside us, outside. And then the Oriental thing was a very divisive thing. I was on a platform with a candidate once in the Fraser Valley who spoke in favor, he spoke ahead of me, I was speaking in his behalf, spoke in favor of keeping up the discrimination. And I had to get up and take issue with him and point out what was the party stand. So that we were divided on that. And then we have fought over the years on many things. But you see, as a matter of fact, this last provincial election is the first provincial election I can ever recall where the party was ideologically solid and where nobody could drive wedges. And this was a great blessing because in Saskatchewan right now,
the waffle is kicking.
Exactly. You see now, I think that we lost two or three seats there in the last election just because of this. In fact, I was in Saskatchewan and I saw with my own eyes in one riding just what the waffle was doing. Because the friends that had gathered together that night for a nice big social and everything else spent the whole evening around the edges fighting over the waffle and the non-waffle at night instead of getting ready to deal with the enemy.
But don't you think this kind of left-right schism, the kind of the ideological purists versus the practical politicians is kind of endemic to all social democratic parties?
Yes, I do. I do, but I think you have to get to a point where you can learn to zero in on the common ground, if you can, and save these other things for... I think you've always got to have opposition. But if you have opposition to the point where you're fiercer on dealing with your in the bosom of the family than you are with the enemy outside, then you don't make progress. I mean, you're so busy fighting among yourselves that you have no energy for outside at all. That's what happens.
Unless you have that left wing, you could just drift so close to the center that there's no difference between you and the other parties.
Well, I understand, but a left wing is a left wing, and frequently we've had things that passed for wings that were anything else. But,
but I think that I would be surprised if I discovered any Social Democratic Party that didn't have this kind of concept.
Oh, that's
going
right.
On all
and we'll
time.
Get it. Oh, yeah, we'll get a fresh wave of it.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we'll get a wave of it out here in D.C. again on something.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't be too long, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But it was blessed that mm-hmm. at the time of an election, we just managed to avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the first time we ever did at an election time.
Well, now you've explained the success of the last
election.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's part of it.
To a large extent.
I think that... Dave Barrett is pretty fancy with the slit work, too.
Well, as a matter of fact, Dave Barrett was wise. He was wiser than most of us. Because, you see, usually we have built up to a nice confrontation at election time with whoever was running against us. And Dave had studied Bennett. And not only that, but Dave's own character. What he realized was that the only way that Bennett could be licked was not by self-righteous indignation, but by humor.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he got out, the classic example is that when he called, when Bennett called him a waffle, he called him a pancake. And when he called him a heap of waffles, he called him a stack of pancakes. And if he wasn't very careful, he'd be calling him a crepe Suzette. And at this stage, the audience would go, ha, 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 ha. They'd forget all about their nervousness about Barrett and the party in being entertained over this. And Barrett defused situation after situation after situation with humor.
Yeah.
And this was very wise.
Let's ask you, could we ask you a little bit about yourself? Your father made some very interesting statements in 1920 about women, and that he supported...
Oh, did he? I didn't know he said anything about women.
A very interesting note in the Tenor book, and I thought perhaps this explains something about the women in your family, but your mother really wasn't an emancipated woman, was she?
I would consider so. I think she was born emancipated.
And yet,
it depends on what you mean by emancipation.
Right. It does, doesn't it?
Entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know what you mean. She was connected with the first little birth control movement in Winnipeg when it was absolutely taboo.
It depends on the time, too, doesn't it?
Yes.
It is zeitgeist.
And she was emancipated enough that her two daughters never had any notion there was anything the four boys could do that we couldn't.
Yeah.
Now, you may not call that emancipated, but that's the very root of emancipation to me.
The reason I asked the question was because I think your mother looms in your book as a very important person.
She is.
And yet, she hasn't become well known as your father has generally.
No.
And,
oh, no, she wouldn't.
No, of course not. But I wanted to find out a little bit about her and about your own career later.
Well, mother is a very big person. I think probably, in fact, without any doubt, I say is, she's still living. She'll be 100 in January.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't know us now, her memory's gone, the last year.
Mm-hmm.
But mother is one of the, I think, without doubt, the wisest person I ever knew.
Mm-hmm.
Her whole philosophy of living is a philosophy of changing what you can and adapting and using what you can't,
mm-hmm.
and being very sure that you can't make inroads on what you thought you couldn't at one stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a very wise adaptation kind of a psychology, mm-hmm. with absolute, you don't kid yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You have your standards, and if you're doing poorly, well, you don't have to think it's the end of the world, but you know that you're doing short, and you don't fool yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And but she, also she believed very firmly in she would talk to us and lecture us, and I'd get very impatient.
Mm-hmm.
But if she hadn't, but she lived the way she talked, you see. And if she hadn't done that, all her talking would have rolled off me,
mm-hmm.
instead of only taking about 20 years to catch up, which it did. I remember on one occasion a lesson that she gave me that I never will forget. She had told me, I was fairly young, and she told me, she never threatened without doing a thing. She told me that if I did this again, that she would, she had a very large and imposing spoon, and that she would hit me on my hand with that spoon. I guess I'd been particularly pestiferous. And I did it. And instead of hitting me on the hand with the spoon, she took her own hand and she gave herself 6 very hard whacks, and it hurt. Well, I tell you, if she punished me, it wouldn't have that effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You got a handle too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She did.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but mind you, it took time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was in my early teens fighting with her, not wanting to do something and resisting her physically. And then some little time afterwards, I noticed we were getting along much better. And I said to Mother, Mother, we haven't had any fight for quite a while. And I said, what's the difference? She said, that day that we had the struggle, she said, I made up my mind that I was going to try to treat you like as if you were a grown up visiting here. She said, it worked.
Yeah. Something else that intrigues me is that all the connections that we have through your family to so many parts of Canada. There's that gap in Quebec and probably in America, but your mother's family, Staples,
mm-hmm.
did she have relatives who were connected with the farm movement?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Ralph Staples, my sister and Ralph Staples are first cousins. They're married.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph Staples was for years the president of the Cooperative Union of Canada.
Wow.
And he did the early farm broadcasting. And so
there are connections there.
Yes, there are co-op connections there.
What about your own, in your own life, in your own career? You were content to be a married woman and a housewife for a good part of your life?
My husband would say that was a severe exaggeration. As a matter of fact, he did say it at one time. No, I used to go out and I worked for many years. I would go to the office with him, you see, and put in a regular working day the same as he did, without being paid on a very long time.
So you shared his life to large.
Yes, very. Mind you, we began public speaking on the same platform. I was just after we'd been married.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, they began doubling up and putting me for women's meetings in the afternoon as well as a public meeting. And then finally they decided I would go off on speaking trips for myself and things mm-hmm. like this. So again, you see, unless you're in a limelight elected position, mm-hmm. there's absolutely no position, no publicity attached.
Mm-hmm.
But for many, many years, for far more years than I have been a member or was a member in the provincial house, I've been doing exactly the same kind of work without salary and probably more of it, at least as much.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one rather misjudges women who may decide on a role that's a little different from either the housewife or the women's lib.
Yeah.
You know, you may have other roles besides that.
Well, I didn't work it out. But when I read this comment of your father, mm-hmm. perhaps it explains to women in his family the fact that he felt this way, that they are freer to find some sort of satisfaction.
No, actually, my father never gave any thought particularly to, I think, to the whole role of women. I don't think he ever gave thought to it. You see, there's a limit to what you can give thought to.
Right.
And,
but there were very active women in Winnipeg at the time, and he must have been aware they were in his audience. Perhaps it was a passing thing.
Yes, it might be, but mm-hmm. I don't think, for instance, I'm quite sure if anybody had said the word birth control to my father, let alone abortion,
mm-hmm.
his reaction would be, oh, shaw. Well, you know.
But this didn't prevent your mother from being...
Not a bit.
No.
Oh, no. Oh, indeed it wouldn't. No, mother was a very definite person in herself. And you see what she did. Mother was a very successful high school teacher in Ontario. She taught for 7 years. And she just made up her mind that what the role she wanted to play was to help further what my father was doing.
Yeah.
That was her her idea, because she believed in it. And you see, in those days, there wasn't anything in the way of reliable birth control. I mean, they were just starting to study it.
Mm-hmm.
And you either could do like Agnes MacPhail. Agnes MacPhail told me once that she had observed her own mother, who had slaved over the kitchen cook stove with all the sat irons and the lamp chimneys to clean and everything else, and that Agnes was interested in ideas. And her mother had been a very able person and had been tied down to the house as any farm woman was. And that Agnes had realized that the only way that she could afford to be interested in ideas was to have no family and no husband.
Mm-hmm.
And that she had made up her mind very early that this was what she was going to do. Now, I know that a number of times she was tempted off the straight and narrow path to get married and have family, but she knew, and she was right. In those days, there wasn't any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to do it, and she was prepared to pay the price.
That's very interesting. About your own political career, what has given you the most satisfaction in this long political career that you've had, that you feel that has been an achievement?
Probably, and this may sound ridiculous, I have not thought about it before,
mm-hmm.
but probably the fact that I have lived long enough to be able to be standing on my own feet, in my own mind as well as in the public mind, and to have emerged from under the shadows of my relatives.
Ah,
very interesting. Yeah.
And you have done that. And very successfully.
Yeah. I think so. I used to begin my speeches years ago when I was just starting out, that I labored under two disabilities, my father and my husband.
And there are a lot of people who know who you are, but they don't know who J.S. Woodsworth was. or who Angus, McKinnon was.
Well, right, you see, this McKinnon. Is it. It's a matter of longevity, but I've been fortunate.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very good note to end our
good
interview on.